Les programmes de SBS sont disponibles en podcast et vous pouvez les écouter quand vous voulez. Pour s'inscrire ou télécharger, www.sbs.com.au/french.
We've got the great pleasure of welcoming on SBS French Mr. Barry Long, who is an Anzac veteran. I should say that you are a Vietnam veteran. And welcome on the program.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Perhaps, first of all, I'd like to ask you, because we are in Perth at the moment and the Anzac Day celebrations were cancelled. How did you celebrate the 25th of April?
They started last year with the dawn service on the driveways, which was a pretty big success. And then everyone did that again this year. The Australian War Memorial put out small plaques for people to purchase, and it was letterbox cover, so it showed the dawn service, and people got out there with their torches or
candles
and so forth, and those that could get music going played the Last Post and Reveille. It was quite good. It became better this year. In fact, you could see all down the streets, all the twinkling lights everywhere.
You are a Vietnam veteran. You were there in Vietnam.
I was with the Australian Army Training Team, Vietnam, which was a group of advisors. Mm-hmm. We went up 100 strong at a time, and overall there was only 1,008 involved in the whole period. The period was from the 1962 mm-hmm. to 1972, which meant we were first in and last out. But my period of service was between 1970 and 71.
The war memorial, the Grove, which is at the Canungra base in Queensland. Mm. Have you had the chance of visiting the memorial?
Yes, been there many times.
Yeah.
My wife and I have been, we've either driven over or flown over and attended the service, which is usually held on the birthday. That's the 31st of July each year. This year it'll be Saturday the 31st, actually on the day. Usually it's the Saturday closest to. So we're hoping we might be able to get over there again this year. But my tree is going quite well, actually, of the 1,000 trees that are in the grove. Mine's about 40 foot high now. They're all rainforest trees planted in the grove. And it's been expanded on from, when it started about 15 years ago, it's now expanded to a really first-class area.
Let's talk about the AATTV. And so what I can gather is the soldiers were deployed in pairs with members of the South Vietnamese Army. And you met a very good friend through that. His name is Harry. He's Major Tran Ngoc Wai. Tell us about that partnership with him.
I arrived in Vietnam on my birthday in September. And after two or three weeks of receiving information and so forth as to what we were going to do and where we were going to do it, I moved up and met Harry. He was the commander of the 2nd Battalion, 2nd Regiment, 1st Arvin Division in a place called Dong Ha, the northernmost base.
And what was your role in the unit?
Actually, we didn't go up as pairs, sort of thing. It was very varied. The training team went from the south, right dead south, right up to the border, and we worked on the border itself, the river. And my role was as regarded as a heavy weapons advisor. Other American that was with us was a light weapons advisor, and we had a major who was the advisor to the commander, which was Harry. So they usually stayed on base, and we took it in turns and going out into the field, mm-hmm. swapping 10 days at a time, patrolling. That's how our operation went. Other operations were could be individuals with more experience and more rank, and they were actual commanding units themselves and going out in the field. Then there was groups of four. It was so diverse, it was all so different, dependent on your situation. So in our case, it was three, two Americans and myself. And in our area, there was only 19 Australians, all up. So we didn't get to see each other very often. It was only on occasions. So I got a bit lonely out there, and lonely for American twang, American talk. Oh, wrong, Australian. Sorry, Australian talk. But Harry was a very jovial man. He was strict, and they all knew he was strict. Actually, he was the hero of a unit called the Hakpau, or Black Panther unit. And during the Battle of Wei in 1968, he commanded the Hakpau, and they virtually routed a regiment of North Vietnamese, mainly because they were born in the area, they lived there, they knew the back streets, they knew everything. So they could sneak up behind the groups and put them into disarray. So he got the American Silver Star during that period. And then he was a captain then. So then he was promoted major and put in charge of the 2nd Battalion, where I went.
And you yourself have read that you were once reported KIA, which is killed in action.
Mm.
Can you tell us about that story?
Yes, we were... it just came out of the blue that they decided to do an airstrike, B-52 airstrike over an area, and we were asked to go out, just a small company, to go out and do a BDA, which is a bomb damage assessment. So the bombs would come in and clear an area of about 150 metres by 500, and we would then fly in by helicopter straight behind that. Mm-hmm. And we would line up and go down through the bombed area and see what we could find. Well, this was a bit of a disaster because they flew us in the helicopter. They wouldn't land. We had to leap out and onto a sand hill, form up, and the captain was having trouble getting his group organised. So I found a shell scrape, a small area that just covered me to about here. And I got tired of waiting, so I sat down in that. My radio man was beside me and a couple of others standing. And nearly all Australians anyway, wore the bush hat. They wouldn't wear the helmets. All the Indigenous soldiers had the helmets on. I heard this whooshing sound coming at me. I instinctively ducked. And that's all I can recall for a year, an hour or more.
So you were reported killed in action?
Yeah. What happened was, it was a rocket came in, a direct hit on my radio man and the others beside me. They just sort of disappeared, blew them up. The commander then found two articles, a piece of holster from a pistol that I had. My radio man had a pistol also, because he couldn't carry a rifle. And I had a very distinctive scarf. All the Australians had this knitted scarf, which we used for all sorts of things, from cleaning rifles to washing your face. Mm-hmm. And we wore it around the neck. I got a piece for my radio man, and he wore it like a badge. He reckoned it was great. That's the other part that he found, and nothing more. So he naturally thought I'd been killed. So he called me in as KIA. I didn't wake up for some, I don't know, it must have been 40 minutes or 50 minutes. And I was covered in sand, and they must have heard me coughing, because they looked out and came and dragged me out of there and dragged me around the back of the sand hill with the rest of them. There was a continuous bombardment of mortars after that, so we decided to give it away and move back. I was definitely in bad shape because concussed, badly concussed, and I couldn't get enough water, it was dry. I couldn't walk more than 300 metres without having to sit down and rest. So once we got back clear enough for getting rid of the wounded, called in a chopper, and I went out with them and got medical treatment. But the message nearly got back to the wife. Actually, a story there, my next door neighbour, who is in one of these pictures there too, he had a very similar situation, and he was in a trench. And he reached up to get the radio that was left out, and a rocket hit it and blew half his hand off. So a message went back straight away to his wife, who was next door. Mm-hmm. But they knocked on our door, and my wife came to the door thinking, and then he said, "Are you Mrs. Roberts?" "Oh, God," she said, "no, next door." And then this would have been a week later. She nearly got another knock on the door. But they found me in time and closed it all down.
Mr. Long, let's go back to your partnership with Harry. I'll call him Harry.
Yeah.
And I believe in 2017, you managed to get reunited with him in Virginia, in the United States?
Oh, firstly over here. That's it there, the first initial. There was a final large battle which included the whole of the Army of Republic of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And they were going to go into Laos, take a place by the name of Chi Pom, and then move back and close down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Now, they went in and it was a breeze. They just almost walked all the way to Chi Pom with no problems. They radioed back and said, oh, there's no one here, this is a breeze. But then on the way back, they closed the trap, the NVA, and they threw everything at them. It was a disaster. Harry and his group were on a base called Kajo, which was the gateway to Laos. And that's where we usually operated from. He was supposed to stay there, but when unit after unit was being knocked off, they called him up and said, you've got to come in too. So they got almost slaughtered themselves. He got badly wounded. He lost three fingers and he smashed his nose. He was in bad shape. And being the leader that he was, he ordered his men out. He said, I can't make it. You go. And they wanted to carry him out. And he said, no, go. I order you. So they all left and left him there. And he was captured. And then they realised his rank. He was Lieutenant Colonel at that stage. He'd been upgraded. And he was virtually dragged all the way back to Hanoi. Night after night, no medical treatment. His wounds were festering. And terrible situation. And he spent 13 years in the prison up there. At this time, we didn't know, no information coming back, except from the soldiers, mm-hmm. to say he was badly wounded. We didn't know what had happened to him. So quite a few of us were all searching and making inquiries and eventually found out that he was in prison up there as a prisoner of war. And then when he got let out, he was allowed to go to Saigon where his family was. But he was sort of under house arrest. He could go out in the streets and beg, but he couldn't work. He was humiliated all the way. That's mm-hmm. because he wouldn't give in to him. He wouldn't sign over. And Major Wiseman, the Marine Major who was in charge of us at the time, the senior advisor, he kept inquiring as well and finally found he was in Saigon. He then started secretly sending him some money and then organised that he would come to America and give a speech on how good the NVA were, and he finally relented, which was a lie. So they got him out of there into America and his family, and he was free. But then he took on three jobs to pay back all the money that was spent on him, and got his kids through university. He's quite a guy.
So you've been keeping in touch with him?
Yeah. Only on 2015 that I actually found out that he was still alive. And the company who were doing the documentary found this out, got in touch with him and got him out to Australia. And we weren't allowed to meet. It had to be very quiet and secretive until we met at the Grove. So that's that picture there that shows us actually meeting.
It was an SBS documentary made about Vietnam, the war that made Australia.
That's the one that we're talking about. That's where that started, yeah. My daughter took that photograph.
Mr. Long, tell us about your family, because I believe there's a long history associated with the military.
Yes, well, there's my grandfather who was in the Boer War. Mm-hmm. He was a sergeant in the Royal Dublin Fusiliers and... he was in South Africa through the whole period. And in fact, he saw action in nearly every skirmish that was on over there. He's got the medals to show. And he used to sit me down when I was a little fella and tell me various stories of what went on. And, they talk about Vietnam being the most televised war. But he said... his war was the most photographed. because nearly every person that went over there had a Brownie box camera in his backpack. So there's thousands of photographs taken. He came home, got married in South Africa. My father was born there in East London. And then First World War was coming up, so they decided Africa wasn't the place to be. So they came out and settled in Perth. My father, he when World War II came on, he was a shearer, a top shearer. So he was manpowered out of the military itself. But he and a whole group were under military command to go in the northwest and shear as many sheep as they could and keep the wool supply up for uniforms. So he saw the whole war out there. Mm-hmm. My brother, who there was a 10-year gap between my brother Dudley and myself, because middle brother died young, and he joined the Air Force and went up to Darwin. And then he got shipped out to Nullanbi in the east, and he saw the war out in the Northern Territory. And then he got out a year later back here. I've been involved with the military ever since I was a boy, because World War II was announced as commencing on my birthday, 3rd of September. And I went through the war years as a kid with all the others, and we played games, we played wars. Mm-hmm. And when I grew up and working with the family business in the dry cleaning in Meriden, country town, the Army Reserve units came up there and settled a company. So I joined that at 17. And I was in that for a couple of years, and then National Service came up. Mm-hmm. I was called up for National Service. That's the 3-monthly one in the 50s. And from there, we had to do a couple of years Army Reserve again. And dry cleaning wasn't my thing. I wasn't happy with it for starters. Chemicals wasn't doing me any good. And this I knew well, so I joined the Army. Well, with the agreeance of my wife, of course. Mm-hmm. And that started a 20-year
partnership
with the Army, yeah. Which was very good. We enjoyed it. All the family enjoyed.
And your children have followed in your footsteps?
My son did, yes. He joined the Army, and he was with the 3rd Battalion. The only overseas that he did, because it was settled at that time, was Butterworth in Malaysia. They had the Butterworth Air Base there, and they sent the Army groups over to patrol the surrounds. So he did two tours of that, 3 months at a time. Then he got out and he started work with the Adelaide Advertiser, did 25 years with him. My eldest daughter unfortunately had a bicycle accident when she was 14, fell off, and no helmets in those days. So she is a brain-injured person, but she's well looked after now. We've got her everything she needs. My youngest daughter, Tracy, she went to university. Risk management was her thing, occupational health and safety. So, and now she is assistant director with NDIS, looking after the disabilities.
Mr. Long, is there a message that you'd like to convey to the people listening, to the youngsters today, maybe about remembering Anzac Day every year?
Yes, it seems to be slipping away a little. It used to be, although the crowds are still there, but the concern is the schools. They're not looking after the schools in educating them with a bit of history each time. It should be kept going, kept alive. They shouldn't have to grow up to learn about it. I saw in the paper recently where a school was going to do a parade on Anzac Day, and it was going to have what's known as a catafalque party. They had old 303 rifles, which were made safe. They were given to them for the day. And the idea was just to put the arms in reverse and respect at the memorial. A couple of parents, which I would probably say were one or two, complained. So with their complaint, the whole thing was stopped. Now, the kids were very disappointed. They'd been told so much about it and how to do it and what to do. And I don't think that's right. I think if the majority says go, go, not the minority. That's how it works now, unfortunately. Also, by the way, my great-grandson, who was 15, and my great-granddaughter, who has just turned 13, are both in the cadets in South Australia.
Mr. Long, thank you very much for coming on to SBS French, and all the best.
Thank you, thank you.
Les programmes de SBS sont disponibles en podcast et vous pouvez les écouter quand vous voulez. Pour s'inscrire ou télécharger, www.sbs.com.au/French.